Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisako Res, chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce my distinguished speaker. Dr. Aubrey de Grey is chairman and chief science officer of the Methuselah Foundation. His major research interests are the role and etiology of all forms of cellular and molecular damage in mammalian aging, and the design of interventions to reverse the age-related accumulation of such damage. Dr. De Grey has published extensively on these and other areas of gerontology and is also editor-in-chief of the high-impact journal, Rejuvenation Research, the only peer-reviewed academic journal focusing on intervention in aging. Dr. De Grey has formulated a wide-ranging plan for the comprehensive and eventually indefinite postponement of the age-related physical and mental decline, named SENSE, Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence. Dr. De Grey is the organizer of an ongoing series of conferences and workshops that focus on the key biomedical research relevant to SENSE. And he also oversees the Methuselah Foundation's growing sponsorship of SENSE research worldwide.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. And the first thing I want to do, after simply thanking everybody for coming to hear what I have to say, is to apologize to the organizers for not updating them with regard to my affiliation. Because as you can see on my opening slide, I am no longer the chairman and chief science officer of the Methuselah Foundation. The Methuselah Foundation, just less than 2 months ago, became effectively two foundations. We started a new organization called the SENSE Foundation, and the Methuselah Foundation has divested its research funding activities to this new foundation. So the Methuselah Foundation is now mainly focused on its original activity, which was the administration of a prize named the Methuselah Mouse Prize, or the M Prize, for the creation of unprecedentedly long-lived mice. And the SENSE Foundation has now taken on the funding of research to bring about the defeat of aging using regenerative medicine. So I am now the chief science officer of the SENSE Foundation. I would like to tell you a little bit more about the SENSE Foundation since it is so new. It's a charity. It's a U.S. registered charity, just as the Methuselah Foundation is. And as I've just summarized, we work to develop and promote and, of course, enable widespread access to regenerative medicine solutions to the disabilities and diseases of aging, the ill health associated with aging. We are supporting research both extramurally and intramurally, which is to say that we have an in-house laboratory currently located in the Phoenix area, but likely to move to the Bay Area fairly soon. And we also support research in universities around the world via grants to those universities to professors there to get research done. And our research efforts also are combined with outreach efforts. So I spend a lot of my time giving talks like this, giving explanations of what we do and why to the general public, to people who are not scientists, to other types of academics, maybe theologians, maybe economists, you name it. I give an awful lot of talks. Now, this talk is going to be mainly focused on how we are going to defeat aging. But before I start, I want to emphasize one very important point, because a lot of people get confused about this. a lot of people who have heard about the work that I do and the work that the Sense Foundation does have the impression, because that's the sort of impression that journalists like to give in order to sell newspapers, that I'm interested in extending life, and in particular that I'm interested in indefinitely extending life. And they tend to use words like immortality and living forever in the headlines of articles about my work. But actually, I'm interested in something much more prosaic and something much more obviously desirable, namely keeping people healthy. I have a feeling that most people in this room, however far along you are in the aging process, would prefer to be in the physical and mental state of the people on the left than the person on the right. And that is what I work on. I think, as I will explain in this talk, that we can do that very well indeed in the foreseeable future. So well that it will have a side effect of allowing people in general to live a lot longer than they do at the moment. But that should be understood as a side benefit. I regard it as a benefit, certainly, a beneficial side effect, but it's a side effect. The ultimate purpose is to stop people getting sick. And if anyone in the room wants to get Alzheimer's disease or cancer or cardiovascular disease when they get older, then they can raise their hand now and I will point my laser pointer into their eyes. So, the structure of this talk will be as follows. I am going, as I mentioned, to talk about how we're going to stop you getting sick. And it's going to split into these six major themes. First of all, I'm going to talk very much in the abstract. I'm going to give you the 30,000-foot view of how this might work, of the various approaches that one might, in principle, take to the defeat of aging, and why one of those approaches is a lot more promising than the others. Then I'm going to drill down a little bit into what that approach really comes down to in practice, and that's where I'm going to start talking about real biology. However, I appreciate that most people in the audience probably don't have all that much training in biology, so I won't get too technical at that point. But I'll get technical enough so that you know that I'm not making it up. And then for a short while, in the third part of the talk, I'm going to get even more technical because there may be some actual biologists in the audience, for all I know, and certainly on the radio, listening to the radio. And I'm going to go into just one component of that part of the talk in considerably more detail. That's going to be the main hardcore biology component of the talk. Then I'm going to get on and talk about the longer term. And at that point, I'm going to be discussing not so much science, but rather technology, or more precisely, the history of technology. I'm going to be exploring what we can expect to happen in terms of the rate of progress that will occur after we make what I'm going to be describing as the fundamental breakthroughs in the next few decades. And then finally, I'm going to talk a little bit about how you can make a difference to this. All right, so I'm going to start, as I mentioned, with the 30,000-foot view. And in order to describe how to address any really hard problem, the first step is always to describe the problem in a useful way. And the problem here is aging. Many people have come up with many definitions of aging. This is the one that I prefer, and you'll see why. For sure, aging is a side effect of being alive in the first place. That's why we only age after we have been alive for a while. But I have divided that on this slide into two parts. What I'm defining here is the concept that I'm going to call damage. And I'm going to be using this word damage in this very specific way for the rest of the talk. Damage is the set of intermediates between being alive and being dead. So what I'm saying here is that metabolism, which is the word that I'm going to use to encompass all of the cellular and biochemical processes that go on every day in our lives to keep us alive, metabolism has side effects throughout life. Those side effects, some of them anyway, accumulate. So the body progressively changes in its composition. And of course, I'm not talking here about what happens during the early part of life while we're still growing. I'm talking about what happens during that part of life, but also during the rest of life. Those changes accumulate, and some of those changes eventually contribute to the age-related increasing progressive dysfunction of the body. So damage is the set of changes to the body that are caused by our metabolism and that accumulate and eventually cause the body to work less well. Pathology is the word I'm using for all of the things that go wrong with us increasingly as we get older. So now, what does that mean in terms of potential solutions? Well, historically, this is what it means. There are essentially two games in town. I'm going to call them the gerontology approach and the geriatrics approach. The geriatrics approach says, well, okay, so damage accumulates and it starts to cause these things that go wrong with the body. But if initially it doesn't cause massive problems. So those of you in the room who are, let's say, 60 years old are probably aware that you aren't able quite to, you know, to run as fast and think as fast as you could 20 or 30 years ago, but it's not causing you the most immense amount of distress. The geriatrician's approach to combating aging is to intervene starting around then, to try to slow down, to try to hold back the sands of time and slow down the rate at which age-related ill health progresses so that it takes longer to get to the point where that ill health becomes really severe and you start to be incapable of normal activities of daily life and eventually, of course, to be in danger of dying. And that's all very well, up to a point. Certainly it's better than nothing. But gerontologists have, for a long, long time, felt that it was important to look beyond that, to take account of the general principle, the very well-known maxim, that prevention is better than cure, and to try to slow down the accumulation of the damage in the first place. To try effectively to clean up metabolism so that it doesn't lay down these various types of molecular and cellular change in the composition of the body. And of course, that would have the same effect, but the ethos of the gerontologist is that if we can have that effect at that earlier stage down here, then we will have a much better chance of more substantially postponing the eventually severe ill health of old age. Okay, so both of those approaches seem fairly promising in principle. What's wrong with them? Well, let's start with the geriatrics approach. The fundamental problem is that an awful lot of things go wrong with us when we get older. An awful lot. And they happen all at more or less the same time, and they interact with each other to exacerbate each other. And worst of all, they are all caused by this thing I'm calling damage. These accumulating side effects of metabolism. And because those side effects are accumulating, the geriatrician's job in combating all of these terrible things that happen to us in old age gets harder as time goes on and as the geriatrician's patient gets older. So the geriatrician's job, the geriatrician's approach is better than nothing, but not much better. And the critical point is that it never can be much better than nothing. Because the problem that the geriatrician is trying to solve is getting progressively harder as time goes on. Unfortunately, the gerontology approach doesn't look too promising either. Because the gerontology approach consists of manipulating this thing that I have on the slide. Now, this on the slide is a picture, a very simplified diagram of part of what we know about how cells work. And as you can see, it's rather complex. But, as any biologist will tell you, this is not the problem. The problem is that this is a simplified diagram of a small subset of what we know about how cells work. And it is completely dwarfed by the astronomical amount that we don't know about how cells and organisms work. Even leaving aside all the probably even more astronomical amount that we don't even know that we don't know about how they work. So it's just hopeless. You are not going to be able to clean up metabolism anytime soon because it's just too complicated. You cannot reliably manipulate a system that you understand so poorly as this and avoid doing more harm than good. Now, I want to elaborate on that, because some of you may be thinking, well, hang on, there are a few things that people are trying that seem to be quite beneficial, at least in the laboratory. And for sure, most of those people working on the biology of aging who have been attempting to intervene in it and to actually do something about it and figure out what works in the laboratory with a view to making it work in humans have been saying some quite optimistic things recently. Some of you may have heard of many of these things. Relatively simple interventions, single drugs, for example, that appear to be able to extend by a substantial proportion the lifespans of model organisms. But there are some problems. First of all, these model organisms that are worked on in the lab, let's say worms or fruit flies or yeast or mice, they don't live very long compared to how long we live. And that turns out to be a problem. Because if we look at the evolutionary reasons why we live as long as we do and why we would have or not have mechanisms to make us live even longer in certain circumstances, it turns out to be fairly clear that interventions which work well in shorter-lived organisms will probably work, but work rather less well in longer-lived organisms. And this has led me to the rather firm conclusion that we're probably going to get only a year or two at most out of the sorts of things that most of my colleagues tend to look at. Now, I could be wrong about this, and also, let's face it, even a year or two is better than nothing. Therefore, I'm very pleased that my colleagues are looking at these things, but I aim higher than that. Another thing to bear in mind is that most people who are interested in actually trying to combat their own aging process have already undergone quite a lot of it. In other words, we're looking at people who've already got to the point where we need to intervene. And most of the experiments that are done, in fact, almost all the experiments that are done in the laboratory on other organisms tend to be done starting early in life. Why do you suppose that is? I'll tell you why it is, because those are the ones that work. And experiments that don't work tend to be rather unpopular among scientists that need their next grant application to be accepted. So that's a bit of a shame. It may mean, and indeed we have considerable evidence, anecdotal evidence at least from human studies, that it does mean that many of these things only work because of altering the way that metabolism works early in life. And once the harm is done, it's just done. This, however, is the ultimate reason why I think we need to be very cautious about overstating and overinterpreting the value of what I'm calling magic bullets. Those of you who are already beginning to feel the effects of old age would probably be happy not to feel them increasingly intensely as time goes on, but you'd be one hell of a lot happier if your aging process could be actively taken backwards and you were physically and mentally as agile as you were 10 or 20 years previously. And these therapies, these magic bullets, nobody suggests that they're going to do that. That's what I want to do. And what I'm going to tell you today is that it's not fantasy. Some of my colleagues tried to explain that it was fantasy a few years ago by publishing a small article in Scientific American, obviously targeted to the general public, and they called it If Humans Were Built to Last, and they tried to be a bit humorous about it. They said, well, okay, there are various ways in which the body is obviously not built terribly well. It would accumulate wear and tear less quickly if various design modifications were made. So they wanted the knees to be built the other way around so that they articulated backwards. I can't remember why. Lots of things like that. And some journalists were actually taken in and thought that this was a description of a recommendation of what we should actually do. But, of course, what they were trying to do was to say, well, okay, we're not built this way, so get the hell over it. You're going to die. And that was all very well. But, of course, the reason I mention this is because it may be actually useful in seeing the flaw in this logic. Here is a simple machine. It's called a car. And the reason I put it up here is because we are also machines. The difference is that we are not simple machines. We are very, 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 very complicated machines. But we are still machines, and therefore it may be possible for us to learn something about how to extend the functional lifespan of the human body by looking at how we already succeed in extending the functioning lifespan of much more simple machines, such as this one. Now, this is a car that was built to last. A Land Rover is built to last a lot longer than your average car, and sure enough, this one, which is more than 50 years old, got that way because it has corrosion-resistant fuselage, so to speak, and very tough tires and all those good things. But the reason I have called this slide "If VW Bugs Were Built to Last" should be clear to you if you think about it. The reason is very simple. The reason is that there are just as many 50-year-old VW Bugs driving around the streets of the USA as there are 50-year-old Land Rovers. And the reason why there are just as many VW Bugs is not that VW Bugs were built to last. It's because they've got style. This car was built in the same year as the one on the previous slide, and it is doing just as well. And the reason is that its owners fell in love with it and have looked after it exceptionally well. And that's all it took. Maintenance works on cars and on planes and on nuclear power stations, you name it. So that is very good reason to believe that it should work on much more complicated machines such as the human body. So let's go back to biology. This is basically what I'm saying, that in addition to the gerontology approach and the geriatrics approach, there is a third, completely, fundamentally different way to go about the problem of combating aging and postponing age-related ill health. I like to call it the maintenance approach, you could call it the engineering approach, whatever. The thing is, what it's about is not interfering in the process that turns metabolism into damage, nor intervening in the process whereby damage creates pathology. Rather, intervening to repair the damage itself. So what we do is we let the damage be laid down and we eliminate it, not necessarily completely, but fairly well, so that it never reaches the level of abundance that causes pathology, age-related ill health. And I claim, this is my first outrageous claim of the evening, my claim is that the engineering approach, the maintenance approach, is much more feasible, much more promising than the other two approaches. Very simple from this diagram to see why I say that. It avoids the shortcomings. It avoids the pitfalls of the other two approaches. You'll recall that the pitfall of the geriatrics approach is that it's too late in the game. It intervenes to try to prevent the consequences of a problem that is getting worse. The maintenance approach doesn't do that. By definition, damage is the ongoing immediate side effects of metabolism, so it has no accumulating precursor. So the maintenance approach does not get harder as time goes on. Conversely, however, the maintenance approach intervenes late enough in the chain of events from metabolism to pathology that it doesn't have the problem of the complexity of metabolism. Here what we're saying is we'll let metabolism lay down damage in the normal way, but in particular we will let it lay it down at the same rate that it naturally does so, which means we don't have to understand how it does so. All we need to understand is what it lays down. We need to characterize damage and figure out how to fix it, and then we can let metabolism get on with doing what it knows how to do. We don't have to fix it, therefore we don't have to understand it. So the maintenance approach seems to be very promising indeed. Okay, that's enough of the abstract. Let's get on to some biology. Now, I've told you so far that the maintenance approach is the most promising, but I've only told you one reason why it's the most promising, namely that it targets the weak link in the process that goes from metabolism to pathology. There's a second reason, which is this. The target of the maintenance approach, namely damage, is not so complicated as either its causes or its precursors or its consequences. This is all we need to fix, in my view. This is my second outrageous claim of the day, that all of the various biological phenomena that qualify as damage by the definition I've been giving you fall into one or other of these seven categories that I'm listing here. Things like junk inside cells, by which I mean indigestible molecules, molecules that are created as byproducts of metabolism and that the cell does not know how to either destroy or excrete, so it just sequesters them and eventually they accumulate to a level that is problematic. Let's take number three, which is too few cells, so cells dying and not being automatically replaced by the division and differentiation of other cells. This is something that certainly happens all the time in certain tissues, such as the heart and certain areas of the brain, and it certainly causes problems, such as Parkinson's disease. So you can go down this list. Now, this list, you maybe wonder, well, why do I say that it's comprehensive? How can I be so confident that nothing that qualifies as damage falls outside these seven categories? One reason is biological. I can say, well, okay, look, damage can only accumulate in long-lived structures, because if a structure is, if a protein, for example, is synthesized and it does its job for a while and then it's oxidized in some way, it's damaged, and then it gets broken down, then the damage is not accumulating. So that doesn't count as damage by the definition I'm using tonight. Whereas in DNA, for example, if a mutation happens, that's persistent. Okay, so that's one way to get to this list of seven categories. The other way is simply circumstantial, but very powerful. Namely, it's been the same list for more than a quarter of a century. All of these seven types of damage have been discussed extensively by gerontologists since either the early 80s or in many cases a lot earlier. And we really ought to have added to this list by now if there were anything to add. But of course, that's not the best news. The best news is my third outrageous claim of the day, which is that we know how to fix all of these things. Now, I'm not saying we can fix all of these things yet, but we know how, by which I mean we can describe in a lot of detail how we would go about not just slowing down, not just stopping the accumulation of these various types of damage, but actually repairing that damage, which is what the maintenance approach is. So in the case of cell loss, which I mentioned a moment ago, of course, that's what stem cell therapy is for. When a tissue is not automatically replenished by the replacement of cells that die, we can replace those cells ourselves, not yet in most cases, but in the future, by introducing stem cells that will differentiate and replace the cells that have died. If we go down the list, we can look at, for example, the removal of amyloid. Amyloid is not junk accumulating inside cells, but outside cells, and it turns out that if you can get it inside cells, then it goes away, more or less, and people have got rather good at doing that using vaccination. This is something that's already reached phase 3 clinical trials in the case of amyloid and Alzheimer's disease, and we're hoping very much to be able to get similar research going for other types of amyloid. You can go down the list and you'll find types of intervention that are a good deal further away from implementation, but nevertheless that are going very nicely so far. And these are things, especially the ones, the hardest ones towards the bottom of the list, are the ones that my foundation is most interested in supporting so that they, if you like, catch up with the others. But everything on this list we can describe in some detail. Here I'm just describing them in a few words for each one, but the book that I published a year or two ago, which describes this whole thing in as much detail as you can imagine, allocates an entire chapter to each of these seven types of intervention. So, as you can see, there's an awful lot to say. And that's really good news, because, of course, the more you know about the detail of how you might solve a problem, the more confident that you can be about how quickly you'll solve it. So I'm going to go into a bit more detail just to reassure you that I'm not making all this up. But because there's so much detail involved, I can only go into detail in one of the seven areas, which is going to be the accumulation of indigestible byproducts of metabolism inside the cell. And this is going, in my view, to be most easily fixed by using what I'm calling here transgenic microbial hydrolases, by which I mean enzymes taken from bacteria in the soil that we introduce into our cells. We don't introduce the bacteria, I emphasize, we only introduce the enzymes. Now, the problem is severe. Here is a picture with an electron microscope of the sort of thing that happens in the Alzheimer's brain. This is a cross-section through the long part of a neuron, the axon, and it shows a whole bunch of stuff that really ought to not to be there, ought to have been broken down, and it has not been broken down because the degradation machinery of the cell has been messed up by its inability to break down certain stuff. In the next slide, I've got here the same sort of thing happening in the artery. Here, we have a completely different type of molecule that's accumulating. In this case, it's oxidation derivatives of cholesterol, and the cells are looking very different, but they have fundamentally the same problem, an inability to break things down and process material that they ought to break down. So how do we solve it? Well, about 50 years ago, a professor in Cambridge called Ernest Gale came up with an interesting idea for getting rid of pollutants in the environment. He realized that a lot of pollutants are organic molecules that are energy rich. In other words, if you're a bacterium and you can break them down, then you can live off them. And he realized that the presence of such material in the environment might be the explanation for why the bacterial ecology in any single environment is so diverse as we find that it is. He realized that even if you're a relatively slow-growing, relatively puny bacterium, you can do awfully well if you happen to be able to break down something that's in the environment and that's energy-rich and that none of your competitors can break down. And so he thought, well, maybe there's quite a lot of those bacteria around. And sure enough, it turns out to be the case. If you go to a disused airfield and you'd like to build a housing estate on it, but you can't because it's got TNT in the soil, then the best way to deal with that problem is to look closely at the bacteria in that soil, because you will tend to find that there are some which actually are already chewing up that TNT. And the only reason there's any TNT left is because there are not enough of those bacteria. So what you do is you get them out into the laboratory, you isolate the ones that can break down the TNT, you grow them up into larger numbers, you stick them back in the soil, and your TNT goes away and you can build your housing estate. And it really works. This is not just an academic idea. This is an extremely lucrative commercial concept called bioremediation. And, you know, people, bacteria are found regularly that can break down PCBs, can break down dioxins, even rubber at the side of the highway. I realized that there are environments that are enriched in human remains. This is an idea that I had in about 99 and published a few years later. And it's now a major theme of research that my foundation is supporting. I realized that graveyards actually accumulate some components of human remains, namely bones and teeth. But those are, of course, the components that are not energy rich. You can't live off those if you can eat them. Whereas it doesn't accumulate these substances like oxidized cholesterol or proteinaceous aggregates that accumulate in cells and cause the problems I described earlier. And I suggested that maybe the reason why they don't accumulate in graveyards is because graveyards have bacteria that can break these things down. So the biomedical application of this observation was very straightforward, that maybe we can figure out how they break it down, what genes they have, what enzymes they have that actually allow those bacteria to live off these substances. And if we can find those enzymes, then we may be able to introduce the similar genes into our own cells using gene therapy or enzyme therapy so that we can get rid of the stuff that we normally can't get rid of. This is the idea in graphical terms. There's a natural process in the human body that turns young people into old people and eventually into dead people. And then there's a completely different process encoded in the microbial ecology that turns dead people into decomposed people. And that is the process that we need to understand. When we do understand it, we can use standard molecular biological techniques to manipulate our own cells. This is my absolutely terrible cartoon of a neuron. And by doing so, we can slow down or indeed reverse the process that turned young people into old people in the first place. It turns out that it does work. This is a representative experiment that happened in a laboratory that we are supporting. And it is focused on a compound called 7-ketocholesterol, which is probably the public enemy number one in atherosclerosis, the most abundant and the most toxic derivative of cholesterol. And what's being shown on this graph is that we took a whole bunch of different strains of bacteria and we gave them 7-ketocholesterol to live off. And we didn't give them anything else to live off. So if they couldn't eat it, then nothing much happened. And as you can see, that was generally the case. We have these horizontal lines showing no change in the abundance of this substance. However, you can also see that two of these strains were not the same at all. They were able to metabolize this stuff, and in only 10 days it was entirely gone. So this is the sort of thing that we've been finding, and this was published last year. We're publishing a whole bunch of other stuff at the moment because we're moving forward at a nicely encouraging pace with all of this. This is one of the things we're doing next. We're trying to find out how these bacteria are succeeding in this process, and one way to achieve that is to use something called mass spectrometry to identify the breakdown products of the reactions that the bacteria are performing. And that is how we can figure out what reactions they're performing. So this is the sort of thing we're doing. It's very complicated, and I won't talk about it any further right now, but you can certainly ask me later. Now, I'm not trying to pretend that this is easy. This is a really, really tough problem, fixing atherosclerosis and Alzheimer's disease and so on. But the approach that I've just described to you over the past few minutes is unbelievably promising. It is going, when it works, to be so much more effective than anything we have today or even anything that we have coming down the pike that we absolutely have an imperative to pursue it as quickly as possible. It may be 10 years, it may be 20 years before we really get this to work. But that's okay, because the sooner we start, the sooner we'll finish. And nothing has any real prospect of coming along any time in the interim that will compare in terms of its therapeutic efficacy against these absolutely extraordinarily prevalent and debilitating age-related diseases. All right, that's the biology component of the talk. I'm now going to get on to what I call longevity escape velocity, and you'll see what I mean in a moment. The title of my talk, as you may have noticed, was Prospects for Defeating Aging Altogether. But if you look closely at the slide that began the last section of the talk, you will have noticed that it was headed only 30 years. It was headed extending life by 30 years, postponing the ill health of aging by 30 years. So what's the catch? 30 years is obviously not just defeating aging. Well, first of all, I want to explain why I think that the therapies I have been mentioning so far will only give 30 years. And the answer is very simple. They will not be comprehensive. All of these seven things on the left, these problems of aging, need to be addressed in order to extend lifespan more than a few years, because they all contribute very significantly to some or other aspect of aging. Indeed, there's one or another aspect of aging for each of those things for which it is the primary contributor. But we don't have to fix any of them completely. And the therapies that I am mentioning on the right will not fix them completely, at least not anytime soon. They will be fairly good, but not totally perfect. So that's why we'll only get maybe 30 years out of these therapies. So what's the catch? Why do I talk about defeating aging altogether? And why, in fact, do I talk about defeating aging altogether that will benefit people who are already alive and perhaps already in this room? Ultimately, it comes down to this. The third reason why the maintenance approach is so much more attractive than either the gerontology approach or the geriatrics approach. I've told you that the maintenance approach targets the right component of the aging process, the weak link. I've explained to you why that weak link is not only more appropriate but also simpler. But the biggest reason of all is that repairing damage, the maintenance approach, buys time. In other words, if you're, let's say, 60 years old and we apply these therapies to you, then we take you back to being biologically not 20, but let's say 40, then it's going to be another 20 or 30 years before you are biologically 60 again. And that's a hell of a long time for more stuff to happen, for more stuff to be discovered, for more technologies to be developed. I'm going to explain the real consequences of that with this diagram. And this is a rather complicated diagram, I'm afraid, and certainly very schematic, so I don't want you to draw too many quantitative conclusions from it. But I need to incorporate all of this in order to get the point across. The red line on this graph here is denoting normal aging. So on the horizontal axis, we have age, starting at zero. And on the vertical axis, we have this thing I'm calling reserve. Now, reserve is not a new concept that I'm introducing here. It is simply the inverse of damage. So in other words, the amount of damage that you can afford to accumulate, the amount of additional damage you can afford to accumulate before you get into the pathogenic region. So you start off at age zero with not much damage, lots of reserve, and as time goes on, as you get older, then reserve declines, damage accumulates, eventually you get to this dotted line, the frailty threshold, which is where pathology starts to emerge, and shortly after that you keel over. So the pink line is what I've told you so far. If we take someone in middle age, let's say 60 years old, they're not frail yet, but they're not far away from it, and we fix them up fairly well, we maybe remove half their damage, but then after that, they carry on accumulating damage in the normal way. That's why this next segment of the line has the same slope as the red line. We can apply the therapy again and again and again, and we can extend their life more and more. But as you see, the pink line reaches diminishing returns. We get less and less benefit from each time we apply the therapy. And the reason why we get less benefit is very obvious from this graph. We're fixing the easy damage, the damage that the therapy works on, but there's all this difficult damage that the therapy doesn't work on. And the difficult damage is accumulating, unabated, so that eventually, on its own, it is going to be enough to push the hero over the frailty threshold. And it doesn't matter how often and how thoroughly we apply the therapy. So you get your 30 years or so of extra life, but that's all. But as I just mentioned, that's not realistic, because progress is going to occur. The interval between the first and second applications of these rejuvenation therapies to these individuals is going to be maybe 20 years. And in 20 years, we're going to improve the therapies. In fact, we're probably going to improve them a lot. So the realistic scenario is the orange line, where in the second application, we obviously fix the same types of damage that we were already able to fix 20 years previously, but we also fix some proportion, let's say half, of the damage that we could not fix previously. And as you can see, that rejuvenates the person better than they were rejuvenated the first time. So the long-term trend is upwards rather than downwards. In other words, however long the person lives, they continue over the long term to get biologically younger as they're getting chronologically older, just by virtue of getting the best therapies available at the time they need them. There is no diminishing returns. And we have a situation in which the therapies never get to be perfect, but they never need to be perfect. The functional consequence, the functional experience of the beneficiaries of these therapies is as if the therapies had been completely perfect starting from the beginning. So I've called the rate of progress that's required for this to occur longevity escape velocity, and as you can see, in order to describe it in words, one has to write five whole lines, but the concept is actually very simple. There's a minimum rate at which we need to improve the comprehensiveness of the therapies in order that people can stay one step ahead of the problem. And I want to explain to you in the last major part of the talk, just a couple of minutes, why this is realistic. Because, of course, we don't know how fast we're going to improve the therapies. We won't know until we do. But we can get some idea of how fast we might be able to improve them by looking at past technologies, other areas of technology where we've already had this sort of thing going on. Powered flight is a fine one. Leonardo da Vinci probably thought that he was only a few decades away from getting off the ground, but he was wrong. His designs were not successful. And it took a few hundred years before anyone actually figured out how to do it. But the Wright brothers did so. And, of course, after that, progress has been rather smooth and rather steady. And, you know, I bet the Wright brothers would have been quite surprised to hear that it was only going to be 24 years before someone flew solo across the Atlantic, and 22 years until the first jetliner, and so on. Of course, you may say, well, where are my flying cars then? Why did progress stop with Concorde? But, of course, the answer is we couldn't be bothered. Really? Okay, so it's just a matter of commercial pressure, which certainly won't be a problem when it comes to maintaining age-related health. I did some work a couple of years ago on a computer simulation of this, which came to the same sort of conclusion. Here we have a situation in which we get longevity escape velocity. The lines here are summaries of the proportion of a cohort that survives to a given age, depending on how old they were when they first started to receive these rejuvenation therapies. So the black line is the survival curve, as it's called, of people who are not getting the therapies at all. If you're 80 years old before you start getting them, then you don't get much benefit. But if you're 70 years old, then 10% of you will actually survive indefinitely, so long as you don't get hit by trucks. If you're just 10 years younger than that, 60 years old, then we're looking at roughly half the people surviving. And the most important thing about the graph I'm showing you here is that this was a simulation based on an extremely pessimistic assumption about how rapidly we would improve these therapies. I said they'll double in efficacy only every 40 odd years. Now think about that. That's the time that it took between Lindbergh and Concorde. That's a hell of a long time. So this is very, very unrealistically pessimistic, and yet it's still good enough to achieve longevity escape velocity. Cars are the same. Of course, there are plenty of cars around that are much more than 50 years old. This one's more than 100 years old, and we're doing fine. It's going to be 200 years old in 100 years' time. So what this means, of course, is that once we've made a bit of a breakthrough, we will have done the hard part. The world record lifespan at the moment is 122. It's going, therefore, to take that first breakthrough, those first 30 years of increase, to get the first person to reach 150 and the first cohort of people to reach 110, at an average age of 110. But we're going to be so close to completely solving the problem by that time that the first person to live to 1,000 is probably going to be less than 20 years younger than that. That's a pretty scary thought. 1,000 is the sort of age that we would reach on average if every year that we lived, we had the same risk of death that we have per year in early adulthood today in the Western world, and only being hit by trucks and stuff like that. Some people say this. Some people say, well, this is obviously ridiculous. This is obviously you're pulling the wool over our eyes. It must be science fiction, because ultimately you're talking about immortality, and we know that immortality is science fiction. But as you can see, when we look at the details, we find that that's not the case at all, that actually it's a very down-to-earth, straightforward argument that says that this is going to happen. It's inescapable. Some of my colleagues don't like it. They say things like this. Tom Kirkwood and Richard Farragher are two of the most prominent British gerontologists other than myself, and they are not terribly keen on me, at least not in public. I particularly like this one. Aubrey represents the paramilitary. However, I mean, the fact is that it's they who are being irresponsible here, because they are distracting people from what might be possible in order to alleviate suffering and save an incredible number of lives. I'm just going to stop with in the last 30 seconds by saying how you can contribute to this. First of all, as I've mentioned, I've had to be extremely cursory in my treatment of what we're doing. If you want to learn more, you should get the book that I published last year. Actually, the original version was published 2 years ago, but get the paperback, which came out less than a year ago, because it has a whole extra chapter in it. We needed to publish an extra chapter because so much progress had occurred in that 1 year. Obviously, there's our website and our collective email address. Finally, of course, we are a foundation. We're a non-profit organization. You can donate to us and claim tax on the donation, and your donation will be extremely well used, and it will save lives. Also, those of you who don't have any money but do have time, we also want you. We need volunteers to do all manner of different things. On our website, you will find details of exactly what we need, or at least some of the things, and if you have skills that we don't mention, then please write to us anyway, because we may not have thought of what you can do. And I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Prospects for Defeating Aging, all together with Dr. Aubrey de Grey. Our thanks to Dr. Aubrey de Grey for his comments here today. I'm Chisako Res, Chair of the Club Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and I will be moderating today's audience question period. We have a standing microphone here, so if you have questions, please line up behind the microphone.
The oldest living person, now deceased, is this French lady, 122. Very few people live beyond 120. We know from our experience that if you live beyond the age of 70, 80, and 90, medical costs increased exponentially. And I don't think we can afford it. Right now, our medical costs are outpacing inflation, though there's not much inflation now. But in 40 years ago, I had elective surgery. This is 40 years ago. I was in the hospital for 5 days, and the total charge was $650. I recently had an elective procedure involved overnight in the hospital, and the bill was $21,000. I think your program is interesting. I do not think we can afford it.
Thank you, because you have made my point entirely. The reason why medicine is so expensive is because of aging. It turns out that the amount that the average person has spent on them in the last year of their life in terms of medical expenditure is more, a lot more actually, than the entire amount that was spent on their medical care in the whole of the rest of their life put together. And the most important thing to understand is that that's true however old they are when they die, as long as it's over about the age of 60. So people who live to 100 live to 100 not by staying alive through a lot of medical intervention for a long, long time. They do it by being biologically younger than average for their chronological age. They have the same sort of amount of medical care in going backwards from when they die, not the same going forwards from when they were born. That's extremely important for what I've been telling you, because what I'm doing is working on stopping people from getting biologically old in the first place. And this actually is an extremely important aspect, not only of how we're going to afford this, but how we will actually choose to afford it. And this will not be a divisive thing, but rather a leveler of medical interventions. At the moment, a lot of expensive medicine is only available to people who can afford it, especially in tax-averse countries like the USA. But this is going to be something that will pay for itself many times over just by keeping people healthy and keeping them contributing to the wealth of the economy, to the wealth of the nation. So it will absolutely be in the economic interests of the country to make sure that this is available to people irrespective of their ability to pay. The correct precedent is not current medicine, the correct precedent is basic education. It's a good investment.
Yeah, I was wondering about the mind-body connection. I listened to Deepak Chopra, and he said he thinks he's 15 years younger than he is, and his body actually tested to be 15 to 20 years younger than his actual age. And lastly, I read the book by George Burns, and when he lived to be 100, you know, and when he was in his 80s, he dated the 23 to 24-year-olds to make him, I guess, feel younger. And he made it to 100. So is there anything to the mind-body connection that allows you to be healthier and live longer?
There's an enormous amount, yes. The last time I did some of these tests, I came out 16 years younger than I am, actually. So I'm in Deepak Chopra's league that way. And I agree with him entirely on this. However, it is important not to overestimate this connection. The connection arises from perfectly good biology, the fact that stress is bad for you. Stress hormones accelerate a lot of problems in health, including especially problems in aging. So for sure, that's very important. And one thing that's very interesting about people who reach the age of 100, they don't have very much in common. Some of them, like George Burns, actually smoke. Okay, but they do have one thing in common, which is their temperament. Nothing bothers them. Hmm. That's a really important thing. So it tells us that the mind-body connection is very important. However, one thing that we absolutely, totally have to bear in mind is that it only makes a small amount of difference. It might give you an extra few years if you can sort yourself out and stop getting anxious about things, but it certainly won't give you 30 years, let alone 300 years. If you really want to stay healthy, then you need the technologies that I've been talking about today.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I enjoyed your talk, and my name is Lori, and I was wondering if you heard of an enzyme that was recently discovered with New Skin Enterprises and working with Purdue University called Arnox.
I know the New Skin people well, and I have known the Marais from Purdue even longer. Actually, I've known them for about a decade. So
I was wondering.
Very familiar. Do you have a question about it?
Well, yeah. So I'm using ageLOC, mm-hmm. which is the inhibitor to the enzyme that's a free radical generator. And I was just curious. I know that in October they're launching, like, Pharmanex is, yeah. And so how does that discovery, because ageLOC actually, it's my understanding, stops aging at its source, the signs of aging, by stopping that free radical generator. Is that, because there was one of the lists that you had mm-hmm. matched,
yeah.
You said some age-related enzymes?
Right. Okay. So it's actually very complicated, and to be perfectly honest, we don't know yet. And the Marais are still going to be in business for quite a long time yet, because there's plenty more to do to figure out really what's going on there. Now, the reason I knew the Marais from a long time ago was because this is an area that was really the first area that I personally worked in, even before I became even slightly a troublemaker, more than 10 years ago, on the possibility that cells which become taken over by mitochondrial mutations survive rather than just dying, and they survive by overexpressing enzymes like ARNOX. So it's very possible that this, these things that can manipulate the levels or at least the activity of that enzyme may be very useful. However, it's early days yet. There's a lot that we don't know about this enzyme. The Marais and indeed the New Skin people will be coming to my next conference in September in Cambridge to talk more about it. They've been to previous ones. I've been there. You know, I'm keeping close attention to this, but watch this space. I think it's probably the best thing to say at the moment.
Thank you.
My
and
pleasure.
I will.
This may be a little off topic, but population?
Yeah, heard that one before. Yeah. People tend to worry about the social consequences of all of this. And of course, the first thing we have to ask ourselves is, what are scientists for? And I take the I take the view that scientists are indeed responsible for their actions. I'm a professional biologist. I'm only a recreational sociologist, ethicist, theologian, whatever. But I nevertheless view my role as absolutely encompassing the consideration of the consequences of success in the things I'm trying to achieve. And I get really quite upset at the attitude of some of my colleagues in gerontology who choose to essentially hide their heads in the sand and say it's not their problem. However, having addressed these problems and thought about them a lot and talked about them a lot with people who do it professionally, including people in the general public like you guys, I have come to some rather firm conclusions. Now, these conclusions apply not just to the problem, the question of potential overpopulation. They apply across the whole board of potential sociological challenges, ethical challenges, whatever, to the to how we would run our lives in what we might call a post-aging world. So this is going to be a rather general answer. We may encounter really quite severe new challenges, or alternatively, more severe versions of challenges that we already face, such as overpopulation and the consequences for resources. But in order to evaluate what we do today, we must ask ourselves what is likely and indeed what is possible in the future. In particular, we must ask ourselves, well, what's the worst that can happen? What's the worst case scenario for how bad things could be? Like, you know, enforced sterility. Let's take that as a sort of extreme example. Okay. Now, we have no idea whether that's going to happen, but I'm taking that worst-case scenario, that extreme example, for a reason. What I want to do is to ask everybody here whether that would be acceptable rather than having people die of something that we could stop them from dying of and getting sick from something that we could stop them getting sick of. And the way to think about this is to put out of your mind the fact that we don't yet have these therapies. What you should be thinking is, well, supposing these therapies just, bingo, appeared tomorrow, would you use them? And would you approve of their use and their distribution? Because if you would, then you must logically also approve of work to expedite their development. Okay. So we can look at what humanity has done in the past in similar situations. Let's take, for example, the discovery that hygiene was quite a good idea and could save lives. And, of course, not just hygiene, but then antibiotics and vaccines and all those things. One Pasteur, supposing I was Louis Pasteur, and I was standing up in France, and I was saying, I've discovered how to stop 40% of children dying before the age of one, which is what the statistic used to be. Okay, I can take that down to, like, you know, 1%, 2%. Just, I can tell you how to do it. And everyone cheers and they say, yes, yes, we're going to save all these lives. And then some troublemaker at the back stands up and says, hang on, overpopulation. And I say, no, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. We are all going to resort to this barbaric indignity of wearing these repulsive rubber contraptions every time we have sex because that's going to be better than having people die. And everyone's going to look at me and they're going to say, you're completely mad, aren't you? But look at it. That's what happened. So we can't predict what's actually going to happen. But what we can predict is that when the therapies are available, we'll use them. Nobody said, oh dear, it's going to cause terrible overpopulation. Let's not tell anyone about hygiene. When we figured out that that was actually a way to save lives, we knew that saving lives came first. And saving lives for old people comes first, just the same as saving lives for young people comes first. The fact that a lot of old people don't complain very much about the fact that they're going downhill does not mean that we shouldn't help them. The fact that suicidal people don't complain very much doesn't mean that we shouldn't help them. The fact is, getting sick is something we need to fix. Health is important, and staying alive is important. And if you cannot put your hand on your heart and say that you wouldn't use these therapies, then don't waste my time.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Eric Drayman. Great talk, by the way. I could listen to you all day. I'm very familiar with a lot of the regenerative medicine technology, and you just touched on a pinprick of it. But what I'm interested in is what this gentleman brought up about the cost of healthcare, because what I'd love you to touch on is what's going on with the way healthcare is run right now by the pharmas and the healthcare system and the profit system, which is always going to be there, but it's so – talk about the difference of where regenerative medicine may take it, because we're just completely regenerating the industry.
So actually the differences are much less significant than most people think. And in fact, the differences between the more socialized healthcare that I'm familiar with from where I come from over the Atlantic and the sort of situation you have here are also less significant than most people think. The only real reason why the healthcare system in the U.S. is such a complete disaster is because the society in America is so addicted to litigation, and so an enormous amount of money is wasted protecting people from being sued for doing things that they're from doing their best. You know. it's a disaster, and it's the main problem. The private public thing is just a detail, really. So the same applies to the situation with regenerative medicine versus the sorts of medicines we have at the moment. If you take a short-sighted view of how big pharma make their money, then you'll say, well, big pharma make their money out of sick people. So regenerative medicine would be a disaster. It would mean that people don't get sick and big pharma don't make any money. But that's not true. That's not the correct way of looking at it. Because, of course, these therapies I've been talking about today are not one-off, one-shot therapies where we turn someone into a non-aging human that never needs another therapy. These are things that are going to have to be done periodically. And they're sophisticated, elaborate therapies that are going to cost money. So there's abundant opportunity for big pharma, for the medical industry, to make plenty of money out of regenerative medicine. And the good news is they're already moving in that direction. The whole business model of blockbuster drugs, which has essentially sustained the pharmaceutical industry for a long time, is falling apart and is recognized by the pharmaceutical industry to be falling apart. And for that reason, the biggest companies, especially the most forward-looking companies, are getting extensively into stem cells and other regenerative medicine already, even when no one really accepts, no, not many people anyway, really accept that it's going to be relevant to aging. Once it becomes clear that it will actually be relevant to aging, you know, there's going to be an avalanche of that, and we're not going to see very much change in the way that the medical industry is actually financed. What we will see is a change in what's acceptable in terms of risk-benefit. We will not see, for example, the whole of gene therapy research and clinical trials coming to a grinding halt for an entire year because one kid dies of anaphylactic shock. We will see an appropriate attitude to the risk involved in developing medicines that will save lives.
Fortunately, we have time for only one last question.
Oh, I'll give them two. Come on. There's two people standing up.
Okay.
Thank you, Doctor. I enjoyed your talk, and I think the work that you're doing is vital.
Thank you.
My question is, have you come to any conclusions about the accumulation of emotional or psychological or spiritual damages over the course of a human life, and what effect that would have on these replacement technologies, which are material? Would the non-material aspects of the human experience affect the replacement?
This is a fascinating question, and you're quite right to bring it up. Of course, it's not my area, but I do pay a great deal of attention to it precisely because it's so fascinating and it's so relevant to whether this is actually going to be something worth doing. Now, my feeling is it's pretty clear that actually we don't need to worry too much about this. One thing that I often mention that I feel is very relevant to this is a phenomenon called the reminiscence bump, which is a well-known phenomenon in psychology. Essentially, it's just to do with what you can remember. So if you ask a 40-year-old or a 50-year-old about their life in such a way that you can figure out how much they remember about what's happened to them over the years, then, of course, they can remember plenty about what's happened in the last couple of years. But through the rest of their life, the time that they'll remember most about is adolescence. And if you ask a 60- or 70-year-old the same question, then it's the same deal. Stuff that goes on between adolescence and, quite recently, tends to be a sort of plateau, right? So this basically tells us, sort of what we already knew, that what you remember is the most interesting stuff, the stuff that you recall most often, because, of course, recalling a memory reinforces it. So everything's at equilibrium already. You know, even by middle age, we're already forgetting stuff at the same rate that we're learning new stuff. And that's fine. You know, Joni Mitchell said it best. She said, something's lost and something's gained in living every day. And I think that's exactly how it is. This change in what you know and what you feel and what you think is part of what you are. It's not really losing what you are. It's actually being what you are, that progression. So I don't really think there's much to worry about there. Certainly, we don't need to worry about the brain filling up with too much knowledge or anything. However, there are, of course, sociological consequences here. We can imagine certainly that it may be a good idea not to have people stuck too much in ruts, to promote the turnover of careers so that maybe you'll retire at age 60, same as we do at the moment, but you won't retire forever because golf will lose its novelty value after a little while when you're still biologically 20 or 30. And so you'll want to go back and do something else with your life for a little while, but you won't want to be an accountant again for another 40 years. You'll want to be a rock star instead. And so there'll be a lot more emphasis on adult education and retraining and such like. And, of course, this also has bearing on one of the questions that comes up in respect of population matters. If we have a very low death rate, we're probably going to have a very low birth rate, so people worry, well, where are all the new Leonardos going to come from? But the fact is, there probably are quite a lot of Leonardos in our midst that ended up drawing short straws in their early life and becoming bricklayers, and we'll find them this way.
I would like to ask about what happens as you say you prevent aging, but at some point I assume people will die, and obviously do they not go through the same process?
Not at all. The whole point here is that we maintain the physical structure and therefore the functional structure, the function of the body just as it was in early adulthood indefinitely. So the chance of death does not change from what it was in early adulthood. You can still get hit by trucks, you can still get assassinated or whatever, but your risk of death or degeneration of falling into ill health will not change as you get older.
Right. So how do you think, so you're saying people die just from accidents,
that's
not
right.
From...
That's exactly right.
Thanks to Dr. Aubrey de Grey for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.